This is On the Other Hand. Podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Stay with us as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works across differences to get things done and to bring us closer together. Hello and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, Glenn White, here with my co-host, April Chatham Carpenter.
We had a great conversation with Vic Snyder in our previous episode, and now we'll continue with the second part of that conversation we had with Vic. In this next episode, you're going to hear more about Vic's view on politics and policy discussions, as well as our self-fulfilling echo chambers in which we reinforce each other. You're going to hear more information also about how he viewed his time in the 2nd District of Arkansas.
As a blue, or at least a past Democrat, can you think of some things that Democrats or blues tend to believe that reds don't? That, you know, answer that. Try to explain a stereotype you think, how it's misguided, and what the kernel of truth might be behind it.
I guess maybe I would answer it another way, which is because the Speaker of the House, McCarthy, or Speaker of the House, Pelosi, stands up and says, our position is this, whatever it is, neither caucus of elected officials in Washington is a monolith. And they all have varying reasons for why they may have assured their speaker that they would vote a certain way on a bill. They may also, just because the speakers would say, oh, this is what my caucus wants to do, they may have had a very difficult meeting with their caucus, and it's actually not nearly as overwhelming as they may want to portray to the public. I had a meeting one time when Richard Gephardt was the leader. He was not the speaker. He was never speaker, but he was a leader of the Democratic Party when we were a minority, and I had taken some position, and he knew it. I was going to vote in a way contrary to his view and contrary to the overwhelming majority of the Democratic caucus. But he called me in one day, and he's a very nice guy, and he's always very friendly about everything. And so we talked it through, and I just said, well, that's my position, Dick. And he said, well, how about this? Could you be undeclared? Which, of course, is the worst position to be, because if you're undeclared, then the whole world beats you up until the vote occurs. But I said, okay, I can do that. You know, the vote was like in a week or two or three. I said, I can probably put up with this for I'll just declare myself as undeclared. And so that's what I did, which actually worked to the advantage of the 2nd District of Arkansas, because at that time we had a Republican president. And so the Republicans start coming to me, because when I became undeclared, they thought I might be voting their way. But then I said, no, I'm undeclared. And so they helped me get some funding for the Port of Little Rock, hoping that would sway my undeclared nature. But anyway, my point is, there's just a whole lot of relationships that go on when a speaker makes a statement, well, my caucus is going to go this way. At the individual member level and the individual district level, every issue impacts those districts and that individual differently, and we're not really a monolith, I don't think.
So that not being a monolith reminds me that we oftentimes do pigeonhole people into, you know, thinking that they're going to be like that. And when I think about earlier when you were talking about that conversations have to take a negative turn and how that impacts, you know, that we solve that at the ballot box, so much it seems like of what's going on in our society today has created these silos between us. And I'm really talking less about the politicians themselves and more about the followers of a particular political party. So when I think about, if I label myself as Republican, which I am, that I get labeled and there's a belief that I must look like this, and you're basically saying it's not like that. We're much more complex than the labels that are on us. And so I think about the question that I have is, how do you suggest that at our listeners, and even Glenn and myself, as an individual citizen, regardless of what labels might be put upon us or that we might take, how do we actually continue these conversations about policy ideas and still respect each other?
I think that most of us don't have policy conversations. Most of us are raising kids and going to the grocery store and going to church, and we, you know, my wife and I get into it sometimes, or she's a political junkie, and so we follow this stuff. I think most families don't. I mean, that's why newspapers are dying. Most people, a great, great number of people, no longer read newspapers, if they ever did. And even those who say, oh, yeah, I still read the newspaper, yeah, well, are you reading it, or you just glance at that headline? Or I never miss Beetle Bailey. I mean, I love Wordle with the New York Times. I think that we don't have a whole lot of discussions. I think where we're, and this is not anything anything new that I'm saying here, I think a whole lot of us, though, have gotten ourselves into a self-fulfilling echo chamber. And so we don't have the conversations. We're afraid to talk with the relative that might disagree with us because we saw that they have a different bumper sticker on their car than we do, and we really want to go hunting, and we don't want to get into a big argument. But what we do is we turn on MSNBC or CNN, or we turn on Fox News, or we listen to this, or we have certain blogs that we go to that we really like, as this guy's really speaking the truth. And it turns out what we're doing is we're just all reinforcing each other and in our own little segment of the world. And sometimes you can hear that. I mean, sometimes when they have, if you see a talking head, you know, all these talking head formats, and you think, oh, wait a minute, that guy just said that. Did he get that firsthand, or did he listen to the show 2 hours before where one of the people said that? You know, and if it's something that for some reason you think you may have some insight into that, you know, well, that's not quite right, you can kind of say, well, they're echoing amongst themselves. And so I think that we trap ourselves, April, into hearing the things over and over again, maybe not that we want to hear, but we trap ourselves into hearing things that we think is the truth because, gee, these are all the people that I generally rely on. They're all saying the same thing. It drives my wife crazy when I switch over to Fox News sometimes, but I do, and I actually find helpful things there, and I always read the Fox News website, and I can appreciate how what I think is their, what I perceive as being kind of a slant in terms of the stories they choose and those kinds of things. But I also see some things there I may not see elsewhere. That's a long, rambling way to what you were asking, but I think that that's, I think there is a whole lot, to carry it one step further, I think there's tremendous amount of money being put into keeping us in the echo chamber from both sides. Yeah. And that really concerns me too.
How do we get out of it?
I think that it can be helpful to try to best we can to be a thoughtful listener. And so there are whatever I'm going to talk about TV, whatever the TV networks are and whatever bias we may perceive that they have, whether it's Fox or CNN or Fox or MSNBC or NPR or whatever, there are people on all those networks, all the networks that I value, and there are ones on the other spectrum that I don't value. And I think it's helpful that we, as much as we can, we all try to be as critical a listener as we can be. But I think we just have to force ourselves to read more, study more, and support local journalism. You know, that's what scares me more than anything. I'll say one part. I'm going to digress because I've probably been rambling too much and digressing anyway. I think that we have issues in this country that we did not think we were going to have about money. And it's impacting us in ways that we did not predict, nor anticipate, nor know now how to get out of. And whether it's medicine or whatever field it is, we now have super wealthy people in this country and in our states and in our towns that exert far more influence over what occurs in those towns and what occurs in our politics than is healthy for a vibrant democracy. And so I can say, as I did earlier about the power of the ballot box, and everyone's ballot counts the same. Yeah, that's true, but I also know this person down the street, they voted, and they also donated, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to entities that are going to overwhelm my vote. Or there's going to be money flying in to Arkansas in a local judicial race that will overwhelm my one vote. And there's two ways to approach that, I think. One is to say, well, that's a vibrant democracy, and the Supreme Court has said money is speech, and they get to spend all that stuff any way they want to. Okay, I understand that view. There's a part of me that thinks that's a legitimate thing to say. But what happens when more and more people realize that big money commands the day? Big money makes my election vote and my going door to door for Ashley Hudson, as I did, overwhelms what I did. And that, yeah, we call ourselves a democracy, but we know what we really have is a system of government that is overwhelmed by money. And that money comes into play in redistricting, and it has now made a whole lot of the races pretty much determined ahead of time. That came from money. You know, the power to do that analysis and to push those kinds of things. The kind of legislative bills that get proposed in legislatures throughout the country, and you think, well, wait a minute, the words are about the same. Big money put those together because somebody thought it would be their advantage to thwart the initiated act, the petition way of getting things on the ballot as an example. So I think that's probably what makes me more apprehensive than anything. I think that aspect of things, the power of big money, is of more concern to me than kind of hostile conversations. And maybe hostile conversations come because some people feel that their view doesn't really count anymore. It's being overwhelmed by people who ride in with big money and carry the day. And I do not think that's healthy for America. I don't know how we get out of it. Economically, the power of or the difference between what's the average CEO's salary versus the entry-level salary, far greater than it ever has been in the history of America. I'll pick on my own profession. What does a doctor make compared to what their average patient makes? I think it's much greater than when I was a kid and some of my friends had fathers that were doctors. There were no mothers. It was fathers back then. I think it's much greater difference now. And I don't think that's healthy for my profession as a medicine. I don't think it's healthy for a democracy. I do not know how we get out of it.
I was hoping you'd find a solution in there somewhere because it worries me too.
To me, when I was in the Congress, you know, Asa Hutchinson and I went in the same year. We were elected in 96 and went in as members of Congress in January 97. And Asa was a big proponent back then of campaign finance reform, as was I. And then, and it passed and was successful. John McCain, I mean, there's some wonderful stories that came out of that. And then the Supreme Court started chipping away at it. And this whole idea that, well, no, you cannot limit how people spend their money. And it basically has opened the floodgates to where even the candidates are at a disadvantage. They can't accept big money, but these other big spending entities can. And we're just being whipped now, our political system being whipped by big money who just can overwhelm individual candidates.
One of my concerns about that is that most people with a lot of money and power behind them are fully aware of the art of propaganda and of emotional appeals to get people to feel or vote or give money in a certain way. And part of that problem, I believe, is that relying upon these kind of primitive appeals takes you away from rational, factual arguments. The more people in this country that believe things that aren't true and are basing things based upon emotional tribal appeals rather than what would be a reasonable solution to a problem takes us further and further away from the truth and from reality, and we make worse and worse decisions as a country. That's one of my big concerns. But I know that in your time in Congress, you were quite successful in appealing to a broad section of people in your district. And I know I was one of the ones who went door to door for you at times in the past. And I remember encountering people that you might not otherwise would, you know, give a Democrat the time of day, but they had good things to say about you. And you know, the voting record shows a lot of people voted for you that might not otherwise vote for someone who is perceived as a liberal leaning person. So I wonder what accounted for that ability you had to reach across the aisle, and do we have any lessons there we can use nowadays?
Well, I guess I could say several things. One of them is I always found the 2nd District of Arkansas to be a very liberating district. We have some of the richest people in the country living here, and we have some of the poorest people in the country living here. And by liberating, I mean we have urban areas, we have rural areas. I mean, you could just look at it. And so the reality is, no matter what you do, somebody's going to like it, somebody's not going to like it. So you're probably better off just by not worrying about that and just trying to explore the substance of the issue and vote accordingly. I never worried too much about labels. In fact, most of my life, I didn't even like labels much. But I had the experience as a state senator. So I was elected to the state senate in 1990, and you probably don't recall, but in 1991, in my first term as a state senator, and subsequently in 92 and 93 and 95 session also, I introduced a bill to repeal Arkansas's sodomy law. At that time, it was a crime in Arkansas for a person of the same sex to have sexual relations, private, consensual sexual relations with a person of the same sex. It was a crime. And so I introduced a bill to do away with that. And it was immediately predicted by John Brummett, who has always been a supporter of mine, and I proved him wrong, and he acknowledged that. He thought my career was over because I did that. So you think about that. I went from being perceived as the most liberal guy in Arkansas because I would actually dare to say, well, that really shouldn't be a crime. And where are we at as a country now? Gays and lesbians can marry, and thousands and thousands have. So I'm perceived here as being in the state senate as being the most liberal guy in the history of Arkansas because I did that. I get elected to Congress. And in Washington, I was perceived as being like one of those moderate pro-business Democrats. Well, I'm still the same guy. The labeling people need to get together and do a better job of analysis or something. But I didn't find it was ever very helpful to worry about how someone labeled me if I just would respond to issues and try to analyze them. And sometimes you'd end up on one side and sometimes you'd end up on the other. And sometimes there would be there's always more than two choices. Usually there's about 99 choices, and you just have to find the best path on any given issue.
Where do you think the future might take us here in Arkansas? I'd like for you to think about this in terms of both your hopes and about concerns that you might have about where we seem to be headed.
Yeah. Let's see. I think, at my view, and I'm sure that Governor Sanders would disagree with me, but my view is that the current legislature does not reflect Arkansas. I think the current legislature reflects a political process that has made candidates fearful of what's going to happen in their primary. And because of that fear, they take positions that are more extreme than they would have otherwise if they were appealing to the constituency as a whole. And being a new candidate, you learn from your mistakes, but unfortunately, your mistakes can trap you. And so sometimes what happens is in the midst of a campaign with a brand new candidate, they take a position that seems very reasonable at the time. And later on, after they're elected and they're prying through the issue, they realize, wait a minute, I really made too strong a statement about charter schools than I meant to. Then now looks reasonable to me given how important public schools are in my district. Did I really need to vote for an unlimited number of charter schools? Surely that sooner or later that's going to catch up with my local school district. I didn't mean to do that. But to people's credit, they stand behind what they say. And so I think people can get themselves trapped in primaries that they wouldn't otherwise. I see that true, by the way, for Democrats. I just think it's more noticeable right now in Republican primaries. Historically, my own view, historically meaning the time I was in Congress, to give an example on the other side, I thought Democrats were too quick in primaries to say, oh, no, I will not support that trade bill. I won't support that trade bill. Trade bills are more complicated than my college chemistry book. And for you to take a stand after a three-minute discussion from somebody who's against a certain trade bill that, oh, yeah, I understand your point. Yeah, I'll vote against it. I think is a terrible mistake, and trade bills can be changed. But I think that's a good example. I think a whole lot of Democratic voters benefit from responsible trade bills, but they get that's not the perception in a Democratic primary. So, in fairness to both sides, I think it can happen to both sides. So, I think those are issues. That's the kind of thing I think that kind of messes up the situation. So, going back to your question, April, what do I see going forward? I don't know how we get out of this other than I do think that there are people in these counties that have traditionally voted for Republican legislatures that are going to start getting the hint, this is not really what I voted for. I didn't really vote for you to screw up my library. I don't really want to have a school board meeting get down into where we're screaming at teachers or the school librarian or the principal or my county commission meeting about the library. We were doing just fine before this. If I didn't want my kid to read a library book, I'd get on them because God knows I know they're finding more on the computer than I don't know about than they ever find the public library. That this is not what I wanted. I didn't know that I was voting for this group that came from out of state and put in a online charter school in my school district, and now the funding for my school district has dropped by 10%, and they laid off my two favorite science teachers. They had no choice. I use that as an example because, some years ago, because of charter school and dropping enrollment at my school, my kid's school, there had to be some changes in faculty. So I think that's part of it. I think that there will be a bit of a wake-up call because I think this was a pretty extreme legislative session. But having said all that, I think the way district lines are drawn is not helpful. I think the power of money is not helpful. I don't see any quick fixes. If you had me point to any one political change that I don't think would happen in Arkansas anytime soon, I would say maybe two things. Number one, it is really important that we not let the legislature screw up the initiated act process. I've been a voter who has voted against some of those. I have voted for some of them. But I think the ability of the citizenry to bypass the legislature is really, really important because of the way things work in a citizen legislature where folks come in for 2.5 to 3 months and just do a whole lot of stuff. And after the citizens have some thoughtful reflection, that they may have a different view. And then I don't know, the issue with primary fear, with being fearful of an opponent, so fearful of an opponent in the primary, you do wacko stuff. I have always looked kind of with amusement on states that just take the top two vote getters, regardless of party. But that may be a way to get at whether you're Republican or Democrat, you recognize I've got to speak to the whole student body. I've got to speak to every voter out there. Now, I may not give a damn about those folks out in that, what that neighborhood think about me, because I have never needed them and they're never going to vote for me, and I know it and they know it, but they are eligible. And in fact, maybe I can say something that I'd get 92% this time instead of my usual 84%. But I think there is some ability, I think there may be some value in having a system, and there are states that seem to do this successfully, where you have a primary in which the top two vote getters go to a runoff. I'm not such a fan, at least in my ignorance, of the ranked system. I know it's cheaper, but I do think there's some advantage of having the two final candidates go head-to-head, and in which we can get to know them better. If you have 6, 8, 9 candidates for a state legislative race or a congressional race, you're not going to get to know them very well. But if the top two get into the final runoff, and then you do get a chance to see what they have to say, talking to the whole electorate once again. So that may be something that that states would want to look at, because I think it can happen in both sides, whether you're Democrat or Republican, wherever you are. Why don't I get to vote ultimately for these folks? And it's because of our primary divisions.
One of the things that I thought about in the last election cycle was, as I listened to the ads, the political ads, I was thinking, these candidates aren't speaking for me. And at some level, I became undecided because I hated so much the way that they were taking the extreme views of their party and representing those as if being more conservative was the value that all of us conservatives really wanted you to espouse. And so if they were able to speak more to the undecided people, but I was talking to folks who know politics better than me, they were like, well, they're speaking to their base. They're trying to keep their base with them. And I'm like, okay, but how many of us out there are in the middle more than we are on the extremes? And we're missing something by doing that.
Yeah, I guess when you say speaking to the base, I understand that. I always think that that's a kind of a euphemism for saying, I'm really afraid of them. I'm afraid of my base. I'm afraid if I even look remotely moderate or remotely reasonable or remotely sensitive to a woman who was raped and didn't really know how to address it and with her family and all until she was, 12 weeks or so long in her pregnancy. If I appear even remotely reasonable, I will lose. I mean, it's fear. It's fear. One time I had the occasion to be in the snorkeling someplace and really did that, see that scene that you see in, underwater pictures of where the school of fish of 10,000 fish, all little bitty fish all swimming one direction, and then all of a sudden they dart to the right, and then they dart to the left. Well, that's what a U.S. House member is like. We over there, oh, you scared me, I got to go this way. Oh, no, you scared me, I got to go back this way. We are just filled with political fear during primary season, and it's not a good place to be. And I think that there could be some benefit if everybody had to speak to the electorate as a whole. I also do not like the way congressional districts have gotten sliced up. I was so proud of Arkansas for so long until this last legislature, the one before, because we did our congressional districts by county. We did not divide up counties. And it meant then that every congressional district had a variety of voters, that we did not draw lines down the middle of the street and, you know, let's put those African-American voters in this district and let's put these farmers in that district and because I'm really good with farmers. I mean, we followed county lines. And this is a little bit of a trick, I guess, but and the way the legislature would do it and then say, because the numbers would not come out exactly right. They were real close in terms of total numbers per district. But then it would say, and if the numbers should be, if this plan should be struck down because of the one man, one vote rule, well, then this would be it. And what it would be like, four precincts would be moved from one county into the other one. And anybody who was considering a challenge to it would look and say, all I'm going to do is piss off those four farmers that got moved across into the other district. But the advantages of that was that you did have a little broader spectrum of people that you had to talk to. There are also some very practical reasons to be able to tell somebody when their house has been hit by a tornado that, well, your district, your congressional district is such as call Congressman Hill because he's your congressman for this area. That was helpful, unfortunately, more often than I realized when I was in Congress when we had multiple catastrophes occur. But this last thing that occurred where part of the second district where we had African-American districts divided up and put in literally three districts. I was in Oklahoma for a rowing event a few months ago and started looking at their congressional districts. And they had done the same thing before that. You could just see what's going on. The urban districts get kind of divided up. And I just think that's kind of unseemly. not to mention, I don't think it's helpful to the democratic processes.
Yeah. So you haven't used the word, so let me just throw it out there. Gerrymandering, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. That's clearly what it is. But it's gerrymandering, and you all know this, it's the best gerrymandering money can buy. It is the most sophisticated computer programs and analysis. We know more about every voter in every household, and we can draw lines, and has been done all over the country, so that the legislature does not reflect the votes of the people. Now, a state may be, for example, it may be still a Republican legislature, but it might be a Republican legislature 53-47, not 72-38. My math's wrong. 72-28. And that's where why do we have all these? Why do we have another supermajority legislator? Because the lines were drawn in such a way that it made that possible. And the Democrats get packed into one. And I mean, both sides can do this kind of stuff. I just think that that's unfortunate. It puts our office holders into positions of being the scared fish, because they know if they don't pay attention, that big shark's going to bite them, which is a primary threat.
So we need some help and some direction in what we can do. So I'm going to ask you if you have any thoughts about what either individual citizens or maybe groups, whether they be churches, civic organizations, that sort of thing, what can we do to help make things better in Arkansas? And if nothing else, what are some positive signs of hope you might see? But, you know, what can we do?
Oh, I guess I could say several things. Number one, I don't think it's valuable to ever give up on an elected official, even somebody that maybe I didn't vote for. I can complain about, that Republican there just doesn't care about me. Well, if I don't ever go see that person, why would they ever care about me? If I don't ever go and tell them, you know, when you voted against this particular health care bill, did you really think about the impact it might have on my neighborhood, my family, my business, whatever it is? I do think it's important that we spend time in a very polite way of staying in touch with our elected officials. I do think it's important that we all work as hard as we can to get out of the echo chamber. And if you're just listening to, you know, right-wing talk radio or just listening to, you know, some of the more liberal commentators and think, oh, I'm up to date in the news, you're making a mistake. I think that we all have to be prepared to change our mind about things and just acknowledge, well, maybe I was wrong. I think it may also be helpful to keep things in perspective, that, okay, maybe I do disagree on that specific issue, but is that really an issue on which the future of the country turns? Is that not one that we can just kind of say, maybe we don't need to mess around with that one? Maybe I can accept that that guy voted that way, but it's not all that important after all. I prefer the mallard over the mockingbird for a state bird or whatever it is, but I'm not going to go to the mat over it. Let's see, what else? Recognize that these jobs are really important, that politics is not fun and games. I thought being in Congress was and is the greatest job in the world. I think it's absolutely wonderful, and I hope everybody – I hope every kid is thinking about running for office, and every person who's younger than 75 is thinking about running for office at some point in their life, because I think there are tremendous jobs and tremendous opportunities. And then I just think people need to go into them with the idea of, I just need a whole lot of help figuring out what the right decision is, and that help's going to come from a broad spectrum of my district and from outside that district. I think running for office is important.
I think you know that this program is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas, and I don't know how much you know about that organization, but we work to reduce extreme political polarization and really to encourage people to build, to be able to talk across the political divide by building relationships and working towards finding common ground. And I'm curious about any suggestions that you might would have for us in our work in Arkansas in terms of Braver Angels, of how we can start to communicate effectively in Arkansas. What kinds of things could we be doing as an organization to help with that?
The challenges facing Arkansas and facing the country are not simple. So a library book issue for all the heat and smoke is pretty simple. I mean, if somebody doesn't like that book, it's just a whole lot of heat. When you start trying to figure out what's the best thing to do nationally for an immigration policy, what can we as a state, city, or country do to help turn things around on climate change? What's the best, most affordable way to help people in our country have health insurance, because we know that's good for communities, good for hospitals, good for kids, and good for healthy babies? How do we go about doing that? What's the best and most affordable way to educate kids and young adults through college and graduate school and trade schools to prepare for whatever's coming down the line? Those are not simple. They are complex. And so I think there can be value of people coming together with different perspectives, union member, business person, African Americans, Hispanic, white, Asian American, and sorting through different aspects of that of those issues. I am a strong proponent of needing to do something about climate change. And I voted for the bill that came through the House in 2009, I guess it was, even though I know there was a whole lot of things in there that would not have been good. I thought the Senate was going to do their version and we'd go to conference and get a bill. Well, the Senate didn't do anything and that bill died. But there are so much complexity that if people would come together and say, it is not enough to say, I support the Green New Deal. I don't even know what that is. But I know that there is a huge, long list of individual issues that need to be sorted out and in kind of bite-sized morsels. And maybe people coming together and saying, let's look at some big issue. Let's look at climate change. We're not going to solve it. Are there things in there that we can agree? Oh, this is whoever labeled this part of it partisan. Are there things that we can do about gun injuries and gun deaths in America? Well, who thought this was anti-gun or pro-gun? This is like the red flag laws. I heard somebody on the radio say the other day they were opposed to red flag laws for veterans because that's, we veterans earned the right that, well, wait a minute. The red flag law protects the veteran. How does it help that veteran to let them have a gun when they're at their most vulnerable, when they're having some kind of mental health? I want them to get better. How does it help them when they are in crisis say, no, it's okay, I know you're suicidal, but no, God knows I'll never take your gun away. I mean, how does it help that veteran? It doesn't. I mean, that's not a partisan issue or a pro-gun or anti-gun issue, in my view. It's just caring about that veteran. So, I mean, I think if you come together and say, let's find some stuff in here that we could agree on and push those things, that might be helpful. But recognize there's going to be stuff in there that you won't agree on.
You know, prior to the Clinton administration, I don't remember if in our generation at least there were ever any impeachment processes of presidents. And I know you served during the Clinton administration and were in the middle of that process. And I know we've had another couple of impeachment proceedings lately. I just wonder if you have any perspectives on what you learned back then and maybe what you've seen transpire recently and in terms of that.
Yeah, I guess a comment about that. You know, I voted against the impeachment of Bill Clinton. I was really pretty disgusted with what he had done. Not for like the morality of having had an affair and all that, but why would he jeopardize a presidency? Why would he jeopardize the contributions that so many people from Arkansas and around the country had invested in him? I think it's Hillary was quoted as saying to him something like, "You dumb, stupid, 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 stupid SOB." I mean, I think that's kind of where I came down after all of this came out. But it never seemed to me to rise to the level of impeachment. I mean, it really hurt his presidency. It was clearly something I'm sure that he regrets. Maybe I make two comments. Number one, as much as I could, I tried to keep an open mind, having, you know, at that time, the Clintons voted in the second district. I mean, it was like, you know, he's the homeboy, you know, that's a special relationship. But I tried to keep an open mind. Well, is there something here that rises to the level of impeachment? And it, in my view, it clearly did not. And I tell you what really got to me was one of my Republican friends, who will remain unidentified, was having questions about, well, was this a partisan vote to impeach Bill Clinton, or was it what is the substance? And we know he did some, that this was not, that he jeopardized presidency. Well, this person had a conversation with then Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, and here was the argument about why this person should vote for impeachment. We'll pick up 6 to 8 members in the midterms. What a crappy reason to impeach a president, but that was I have no reason to doubt what this person told me. I mean, it was that kind of a process. The second thing I would say about that is the cultural backdrop of relationships between men and women, I think has shifted some, and I don't mean this in that anybody did anything wrong or anything, but I think at the time Monica Lewinsky, who I love listening to her now, she just seems like this remarkable woman and everything she's come through. I mean, she's, but at the time there was a sense, yeah, she was an intern, but she was an adult. I mean, she was a young adult. You know, I think there was kind of that sense about that. And so we didn't worry much about her. I think maybe the country, it was more like, well, she made her decision. Young people make those kind of decisions. I think there's much more a sense now that in the workplace, no, you really do need to watch out for your junior employees. And whether they're young men or young women or old men or old women, you don't let someone be the victim of, I'll overstate the word, like a sexual predator who took advantage of a position of authority. It's not enough anymore to say, yeah, well, the snack room person, she's 22 years old, it's okay. Well, no, he was the CEO of the company. It's not okay. We have a much better, more sophisticated and mature sense of, I think, what a workplace environment should be. Would that change the nature of an impeachment vote? No, I don't think so, and I don't think it should. But we probably didn't think as a country, not just in the Congress, we probably didn't worry enough about Monica Lewinsky at the time, it wasn't enough to say, well, she was a frisky 21-year-old, or was she 21 or 22? I can't remember, but I think we would have to be more sensitive now to what the workplace environment should be like. And, what is the workplace environment in the White House? What was going on with, that's the one person that got caught. What was the other power players in the White House doing? Did they think it was fair game for all interns? I think those questions will be asked in a more aggressive manner now and probably should be.
I don't know if it's possible, but I think we see it. The partisanship and what can we get out of this, and is that if that's the motivation for impeachment, I have a problem with it.
Yeah, I do too.
I don't care who the candidate is, yeah, on whichever party. It really needs to be an impeachable offense, however that's defined in the law.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's fair. Asa Hutchinson was one of the impeachment managers. I like Asa and have confidence in him. He was a very aggressive prosecutor. The reality is Clinton lied under oath. He lost his law license for it. That's probably satisfactory punishment for that kind of thing. Impeachment clearly was, and losing the presidency, in my view, was far, far beyond what was necessary to chastise a powerful man for how he treated a young woman.
So how would you compare that to what we went through with the Trump impeachment proceedings?
Yeah, dramatically different fact situations, and in both of them. I'm with April. You still want the motivation to be what's in the best interest of the country, and whether it's the country would be better off with the removal of this president, or this was so beyond the pale, like the stuff of January 6th, that we have got to send a statement. This just cannot be tolerated from a president. I did not think it was inappropriate for impeachment proceedings to occur. That whole phone call with the Ukrainian, the first impeachment, was very concerning to me. As somebody who I used to spend a fair amount of time on foreign policy issues, and I just thought that was such a misuse of international relationships, but that was just my view. I was not up there. I didn't vote, didn't hear everything, But my takeaway was it seemed to me to be an appropriate thing to consider in both situations.
Well, Vic, we want to appreciate your time with us today. Thank you so much for sharing some great perspectives and stories with us. We look forward to hearing what you do with the rest of your retirement.
So do I.
We hope you enjoyed the second part of today's discussion with Vic Snyder. Be sure to check out the first part of the two-part conversation we had with Vic, as well as other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand, on the podcast page of the Braver Angels Arkansas website at arkansas.braverangels.org or on many popular podcast sites.
When you visit our website, you can let us know what you think about our program by responding to a brief survey using the link on our podcast webpage. For program or speaker ideas or other feedback, email us at otherhandar@gmail.com. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor. We also thank the Central Arkansas Library System's Roberts Library for the use of their recording facility for this interview. From your host, Glenn White, let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.